You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, April 4th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, John M. Schussler, Associate Professor of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M University, author of Deceit on the Road to War, Presidents, Politics, and American Democracy. Also on the program today, new reports of alleged Russian mass indiscriminate civilian killing in a Kiev suburb. Meanwhile, the Red Cross says Mariupol evacuation is too dangerous. In this country, that independent Amazon labor union wins its labor vote of Amazon warehouses in our state's union vote in, of Amazon warehouses in Staten Island. And just down the road from that, high-end Starbucks in New York City also votes to unionize. Iran says a nuke deal seems to be close. Democrats start the voting process on Ketanji Brown Jackson as we speak, for a final vote, hopefully on Thursday. Over the weekend, Democratic House voted to legalize weed. Viktor Orban wins in Hungary. Vucic wins in Serbia. Both are Putin supporters. CDC finds myocarditis is rare, but a much higher incidence from catching COVID than getting a vaccination shot. And Sarah Palin actually puts her hat in the congressional ring in Alaska alongside 40 other potential candidates for that seat vacated by Don, what was his last name again?
Young.
Don Young. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us on Monday. Back from her brief illness.
So I think I get like an eye infection once every 6 months, something like that. And it's bad. And, you know, maybe I should be less vain, but I don't want to be on camera when my eyes come swollen shut.
I don't think people want to see an eye swollen shut on camera.
Every 6 months?
Something like that. It's like when the seasons change and I have some sort of allergic reaction or something like that. I don't know.
I was a little cryptic about it and people were a little bit worried that you had COVID or something. And I wasn't sure. I'm getting a little red even talking about it. I didn't want to say like, oh no, she's got her eyes swelled up to the size of a baseball or something. So
but yeah,
you let the cat out of the bag. So there it is. Mm-hmm.
There it is. I also want to just give a shout out to my sister who I didn't even realize how often she listens to the show. And she says she listens to it at the gym. And last week, her headphones disconnected while she was working out. And then she heard you saying out loud, gay people are predators and are trying to hurt your children. But like you were talking hypothetically. And so she said she left it playing for a little bit longer, disconnected from the headphones. So the people at the gym would know she wasn't listening to a gay.
Just to clarify.
Right.
I was articulating what the right was suggesting.
Yes.
I say, well,
could have been worse. Could have been worse. Right wing Mandela or something. Like
exactly.
That.
Could have been.
That. All right. Well, thank you, folks, for joining us another week. We appreciate the your appreciation of the April Fool's stuff that we offered. I just want to say again, I had never met Ronald Reagan in person. I had no idea when he. Basically barged into my maid's quarters as seen in that video and pretending to be somebody else to shoot a video that was incredibly, deceptively edited
mm-hmm.
To make me look bad. And I can tell you, I demand in many respects they release the raw footage. But nevertheless, not afraid of him. That's why we played the video on this channel. So
good. I mean, you're getting out ahead of it.
Yeah.
Sort of like the Trump family releasing the emails or stuff that shows yeah. incriminating stuff.
Just release it.
Yeah.
Release it all. And if you want to go to his crappy Substack, pause it, called Pause It on Substack.
Do I've been so enjoying my peril. Email blast from him about all of your misdeeds.
Ugh. All right.
It's informative. I mean, as we unionize here in the studio, it's good to have all the information that we can on the big bad boss.
There you go. Take that to the National Labor Relations Board. Speaking of which, there is what happened at Staten Island factories, the Amazon factories, was huge in many respects. Now, remember, there was also a vote in Bessemer, Alabama. They lost, but they were a lot closer than they were the first time. And there really is a sense now that with the proper formula, maybe it's also the proper circumstance, you can unionize an Amazon warehouse. And we're going to see more of this, and it's going to scare a lot of people. In fact, here are some of the folks on, what is it, Squawk Box or CNBC or one of those things. Yeah. Talking
squawk
about
squawk on the street.
The squawk on the street,
and they're in what the studio. The?
I don't.
All care. Right. I mean, people get paid lots of money to come up with these show titles. Just putting that out there.
Did you watch Squawk today?
I'm into this entire Squawk extended universe.
Yeah, because there's Squawk Box and now Squawk on the street, but I don't see them on the street. All right, maybe we're getting caught up in the wrong.
Nevertheless,
yeah,
a very clear insight into the way that they view people who work in these factories or warehouses.
Does it scale?
Well, we know that the union work rules are what everything is about. It's the same case with Starbucks, too. If you can't tell your employees when they work, then you're really not able to have much of an ability to be able to move product or move coffee. And I think the unions will be in charge of time that you need to work. And that would be dreadful very dreadful for Andy Jassy.
And that's just a U.S. picture, right?
Oh yeah.
They got Europe to think
look,
about as well.
You know, look, one of the problems was, you know, Starbucks does indeed have unionized places in the ones that they franchise. But if you can't control the work rules, no one wants to work certain shifts. So you can just say, listen, I'm not going to work that shift. And Amazon would not be able to say, yes, you must work it. So that's what at stake with union is time that you have to work.
Our thanks to Dee. We're going to watch developments in New
we
York
have more on
and
the
Alabama.
Tech check?
I imagine we will.
Because she's doing amazing work. This is a very important.
There's more. Okay, good.
She's doing amazing work. This is a very important story because one of the reasons why Amazon works so well is because people work when Amazon says you must work.
Yeah, it works so well when that happens, right? I'm old enough to remember when there was a tornado in Kentucky. And the Amazon said, you have to stay here and don't go home despite grave threats. And multiple people died at that Amazon warehouse.
And what is he talking about, really? The idea that you're not going to work, that a union's not going to work with a company if that, you know, people don't want to work the Friday night 8 to midnight shift at Starbucks or something. I'm quite sure that can be worked out. What he's really talking about is not about, you know, everybody doesn't want to take that one shift that is bad or whatnot. What he's really talking about is just they want to operate these people as if they were robots. Like, if Amazon can't tell you that you can't take a pee or that it's got to last only 90 seconds, or that you need to be on your feet for 16 hours a day, or that we need to make sure that you're working doubles 4 days in a row or 5 days in a row, or that you got to be on call,
That's what he's really talking about. He's not talking about a shift that somebody doesn't want to do. They're talking about abuse of workers. You could say the same thing with like this whole thing with an 8-hour, with a 40-hour work week. The companies need to be able to tell that. And this whole thing with the kids can't work. Company needs to be able to tell the 13-year-old, you're in here so at the sewing machine for 14 hours tomorrow. Otherwise, we can't. That's the way we get our margins.
Amazon Union Back study found that of safety data found that Amazon workers had 5.9 serious injuries per 100 people, almost 80% higher than the rest of the industry.
If the company's not able to work their people to the point where they have, five times more injuries than the average workforce.
80% more, yeah.
They may not be able to run their business.
It might be pretty bad for a lot of you people.
You know what we call that? Not a business.
Yeah.
Then it's not a business.
If brutality is necessary, then yeah, we need to figure out another business model.
It's not a business if you, the minimal of worker protections provided by a union somehow is going to drive you out of business. You don't have a business.
I mean, not to be hyperbolic, but like you could, this was a lot of the way that people talked about the perils of getting rid of slavery back in the pre-Civil War days. Those were some of the conversations, right? This is a grave threat to American capitalism, but industry in general. And he's just extrapolating that onto workers in terms of not using their bargaining power and having unsafe conditions.
Without a doubt. Same dynamic.
Yep.
Obviously, the degree of exploitation is different, and there's a whole host of issues that are associated with being a slave that aren't necessarily with working in an Amazon warehouse. But that dynamic from their perspective in terms of the money that they're basically, just extracting.
It's not just carrot. There's also a stick element to labor relations in America that is really jealously guarded and maintained.
Yep. All right. We're going to be talking to Professor Schussler in just a moment. I've got a couple of sponsors today. Folks, you deserve to know what you're putting into your body, obviously, and why on a daily basis. And for me, I guess it was a couple of years ago, my doctor kept saying you got a vitamin D deficiency, which...
Not going in the sun enough?
Not going in the sun enough. I don't know how that's surprising in any way. I know people are shocked by that. But,
you're not a sunbather, huh?
I'm not a sunbather, no. And, there's all sorts of reasons why you need vitamin D. For someone my age, prostate stuff like that, I guess. I don't know. Anyways, that's not the point. But also, it's good for other things that are going around. Well, I've been taking an over 50 tablet from Ritual. They are vegan friendly. Their multivitamin is formulated with high quality nutrients in bioavailable forms that your body can actually use. You're not going to find sugars, GMOs, major allergens, synthetic fillers, or artificial colorants in your Ritual. Plus, the fresh taste and delayed release capsule design makes taking your vitamins easy. And here's the thing. Ritual delivers high-quality nutrients, including vitamin D3, in just 2 daily pills. Your multivitamin should contain key nutrients in forms that your body can actually use to fill in the gaps from your diet. No shady extras. It's available for women, men, and teens. Ritual multivitamins are scientifically developed to help support different life stages. And here's the part that I really, really love. Your multivitamins are delivered to your door every month with free shipping. You can start, snooze, or cancel your subscription anytime. If you don't love Ritual within your first month, they'll refund your first order. Everything I do, like I get on a kick where I'm like, I'm going to take my multivitamin, and I do it, and then I run out, and then I forget, and then it's over, and then I'm like, I'm not getting back. That's why I love the fact that they send it to you every month. I mean, obviously, the vitamins are great too, but it doesn't matter if they're sitting on the shelf of some store somewhere, and they're not actually being ingested into your body. So check it out. Get key nutrients without the BS. Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off during your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/majority to start your ritual today. That's ritual, ritual.com/majority. I'll save this one. That's Emma's favorite. You know what it is. But we're going to get there in a second. Folks, going online without ExpressVPN is like changing while leaving your window wide open. I guess maybe your shade. But in New York, nobody cares.
Oh, my God. You don't close your window?
No.
Oh, I'm religious about that. I mean, not to be weird, but yeah.
You might not have anything to hide, but why give random creeps a chance to invade your privacy?
In New York, it's the ultimate reason you should do it. Sorry. I mean, apartments are close together. This isn't the suburbs.
I'm just like, it's okay.
Okay.
If you want, it's up to you, folks. Like, protect your eyes. But meanwhile, but more important to me, is protecting all of my online devices. And if you want to protect your online devices, you need ExpressVPN. When you go online without a VPN, internet service providers can see every single website you visit, and they can legally sell this information without your consent to ad companies and tech giants. Not when you use ExpressVPN. With ExpressVPN, your identity is anonymized by a secure VPN server. Your data is also encrypted for maximum protection. Works on all devices, phones, laptops, even routers. So everyone who shares your Wi-Fi can be protected. All you got to do is you download the app, you tap one button to use. It is so, so easy. I know this sounds complicated, and before I ever got ExpressVPN, I assumed it would be. No, you tap it once, you forget about it. The only time you get reminded is at one point it's like, did you sign into this, your Google thing from Los Angeles? And I'm like, oh, yes, I did, because that was the server I was using for ExpressVPN that day. Secure your online activity by visiting expressvpn.com/majority today. That's ExpressVPN, ExpressVPN.com/majority, and you can get an extra 3 months free. Go to expressvpn.com/majority. And lastly, one of our sponsors today changed my life during the lockdown-ish type of post-lockdown. I can't remember if it was lockdown or somewhere around there. That is Hello Tushy. In 2022, still we have high-speed internet. The celebrities going to space. Got electric cars, and yet people are still cleaning their bums the way they did during Victorian times. Step into the 21st century, upgrade your bathroom routine, and start washing your bum with Hello Tushy bidets. Because you don't use paper to wash dirt off your hands. Toilet paper is so 100 years ago. The Hello Tushy bidet attachment washes your bum with fresh water for a way better clean than toilet paper. You simply spray and pat dry. It attaches to your existing toilet. You don't need an electrician. You don't need a plumber. It's like putting on a new toilet seat. Installs in less than 8 minutes. Cuts down your TP use by 80%, saving money and paper waste. Hello Tushy has cleaned over 1 million happy bums. I want all of our listeners to have clean bums. Emma doesn't care, but I do. Visit hellotushy.com/majority to get 10% off plus free shipping right now. That's hellotushy.com/majority for 10% off. And tag at Hello Tushy on social media so they can celebrate your clean bum with you. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, John Schussler on deceit on the road to war, presidents, politics, and American democracy. And we will talk about Joe Biden's seemingly, I guess, ability not to enter into this war and what may be some of the forces that are acting on Putin as he engages in it. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us, John Schuessler. He's Associate Professor of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M. Author of Deceit on the Road to War, Presidents, Politics, and American Democracy. John, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So we were interested in talking to you both, you know, as a function of your book, but your expertise in how presidents, I guess presidents, do and don't get us into wars. And also maybe, I guess, the inverse as to how, you know, what kind of forces act upon an autocratic leader like Putin when he makes a decision to go to war. But let's start with your book and work from there. You basically do a case studies of three moments in American history, three big wars that the United States engaged in, World War II and Vietnam and the Iraq War. Let's talk about FDR and to, you know, the extent in which what he did to get us into war, if that is or to put us on a war footing, I guess.
Sure. And this was the case that I worked on first. I should say I was in graduate school at kind of the crescendo of the Iraq War debate. So that's what motivated writing on this topic, but it was the World War II case that convinced me there was a pattern. I think the first point to make about the World War II case is that Roosevelt and a number of his top advisors saw a window to kind of get into the war before Nazi Germany had won. And especially had knocked the Soviet Union out of the war, which a lot of people expected. And the fear was, if Nazi Germany wins before we get in, we won't be able to do anything about it going forward. So this is a very sensitive time in 1941 where there's a desire to get in, but you've got this problem, which is the domestic audience. And we focus a lot today on the, quote, isolationists, you know, various rabble-rousers. But the point here that's important, it was a broad anti-interventionist movement that was catering in important respects to the public, which was willing to do a lot to help the Allies against the Nazis, but not to get into the war, I would argue. So what did FDR do about this? I make a few arguments. One is the Atlantic. And the point I would make there is FDR, if you look at his private correspondence with advisors, with Winston Churchill, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, he's quite open that he's very interested in an incident in the Atlantic between American warships and Nazi U-boats that might create some domestic more domestic openness to war. It turns out those don't have the effect he was hoping for. The more controversial argument has to do with the Pacific and this notion that FDR did not do all he could to kind of pacify the Japanese, at least for long enough to kind of prevent Pearl Harbor. And the problem with making this kind of argument is that you get lumped in with the kind of conspiracy theorists who say that FDR purposely allowed Pearl Harbor to happen, which I don't believe. The way I try to put it in the book is he became resigned to something like a Japanese attack. He didn't know it would come at Pearl Harbor, but he didn't do a lot to stop it through diplomacy. And if anything, he sped it up through the oil embargo. And that's basically how we got into World War II.
All right. So I just want to go back to the Atlantic thing. So he was articulating that he thought that we couldn't engage in World War II unless there was something in the Atlantic. I mean, like how much, I mean, look, I I'm sure, you know, I remember, the Project for a New American Century document that was put out by the neocons in the 90s, that referred to the idea of, like, we could not engage in that area of the world if there wasn't some type of, I think the words were, Pearl Harbor-like attack on the United States. I mean, so, you know, they were sort of, this is speculation, this is conjecture, this is sort of like a academic, you know, at best, at worst, you know, people can go and spin off into all sorts of directions. But that was how would you characterize what Roosevelt was saying about the Atlantic? And then just sort of like how much confidence did Roosevelt have in what he was not doing or doing in terms of the Pacific, that it would bring about this type of.
Sure. And, you know, the problem with Roosevelt is he was just a cagey guy all around. So historians continue to debate what his intentions were, and there's a genuine difference of opinion. I think what we can say is that he knew that if you tried to have a straight up debate in the country about getting into the war, you would lose that debate big. We know, for example, that the draft barely was renewed. I think it was by a single vote in the House at a crucial moment. And there are quotes to this effect from the British ambassador after talking with him that he simply doesn't have the support he needs to ask straight up for a declaration of war. And then, yes, he made a number of offhand comments to advisors who were quite frustrated with him for not being more candid with the public, basically saying, look, all I can do is wait for a quote, an incident in the Atlantic. He said this to Churchill as well at the famous Atlantic conference. The problem is FDR, you never knew when he was telling the truth to anybody. So we truly don't know what to take as sincere and what to take as contrived, but he said this kind of thing repeatedly. In the Pacific, I think the key piece of evidence is that prior to July, August of 1941, FDR tells a number of audiences in public and in private that we can't do a full oil embargo against the Japanese because it would lead them to attack, at the very least, the British and the Dutch in Asia, and that would draw us into the war. And the mystery is, well, if you knew that going into August 1941, why do you then kind of slap the full embargo on at that time? And then when the Japanese show at least a moderate openness to some kind of diplomacy, do you not at least talk with them when ostensibly you're trying to stay out of the fight with them so you can focus on the Germans? And a mentor of mine, Mark Trachtenberg of UCLA, an historian, is the one who really kind of revived this notion that maybe he was more open to war there than we think, because at least it would get the US into the war against the whole Axis. And here the key point is, the average American did not draw as many fine distinctions between the Japanese and the Germans as you'd think. When the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, a huge number of people blame the Nazis as well. They just think, partly because of racism, they just assume that the Nazis must have been pulling the strings there. So Pearl Harbor is the kind of obviously the key precipitating event. And FDR was quite horrified that Pearl Harbor itself was attacked, but they absolutely expected a Japanese attack around this time somewhere.
And do we have a sense of as to whether FDR felt, and I think you maybe were alluding to this, that if we were attacked by the Germans, not as easy to say we're at war with Japan as well, versus if we're attacked by Japan, it's easier to say we're at war with the whole Axis.
Yes, I think it's safe to say that FDR's preference order was, if possible, a war with Germany only. But that's not the war he could get. So second best was a war with the whole Axis that starts with an attack in the Pacific. And I think the word I would use very cautiously is he resigned himself to that as December 1940 and did nothing proactive, creative, if you will, to head it off.
I guess if you also, if he thought that it was going to be inevitable that we were going to have a conflict, better to do that now rather than later when half of your allies would have been defeated.
That is correct. Because we have hindsight, we don't understand how tenuous the Soviet position looked during this time. And the thing you have to understand about World War II is if the Nazis take out the Soviets, there's no way for the Allies to win.
Right.
You could argue that, Britain and the United States would have survived to, if the Nazis had taken out the Soviets, but they wouldn't have been able to defeat them.
I have two more questions about this, and then I want to move on to Iraq. One is, how large of a community was there around? And I'm thinking because I lived through the Iraq War, and it felt like there was legions of people who were sort of on this project. That is to get us to go to war with Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
What was the context during, with FDR? I mean, you say that there was his advisors were a little frustrated. Like, was there, how much of, were there a lot of people, or was he just sort of like, doing this solo? And then I guess another question might be somewhat unrelated, might be outside of the scope, but how much did the U.S. neutrality in the Spanish War influence his decision as to, better to get in early than late?
So on the first, this was a very tumultuous moment across American society. There was a debate at every level between, quote, interventionists who were willing to risk war against the Nazis in order to keep the Allies in the fight, and anti-interventionists who were not willing to risk war. And you find interventionists and anti-interventionists, within the Roosevelt administration and society at large. But the top people around Roosevelt were much more on the interventionist side. And of course, they enjoyed support from a whole a range of groups in society, that the most prominent being the Committee to Defend America by Aiding the Allies. There was an even more hawkish group, I think, called the Century Group, that formed as well. Society was fully mobilized around this question of getting into the war or not. In a way, it was a much fuller debate than we saw before Iraq. More people were engaged, and they were more vocal on both sides. But yes, there were a large number of people at every level kind of making the case for pushing harder and harder to ostensibly to keep the British and the Allies in the fight. But everybody understood that that would probably eventually lead to getting into the war.
And that question about the Spanish War, how much did that influence what FDR's thinking was? Do we know?
This is an aspect that I don't know as well, except it is interesting to chart Roosevelt's opinions on neutrality more generally. In the late 30s, when the war in Europe first breaks out, FDR is not immediately aggressive about getting rid of these neutrality acts that Congress had passed that kind of constrained his freedom of action. And he paid some lip service to neutrality in the early going. But by the time France falls and it's really important to keep Britain in the fight, there's a pretty aggressive effort to kind of do away with the legacy of neutrality and to more openly side with one side over the other. Now, I would just say Spain was not sufficient to, precipitate this change. It took a series of, blows and a softening of public opinion. The public never resigned itself or came to approve entry into the war. But it is true that the public became much more hawkish about supporting Britain.
In terms of that expanded sort of chorus that is pushing the president or is either supporting the president. And I guess that you know, that's another sort of subsidiary question. It's like, you know, and that may be a different answer during with FDR than it was during Bush, for instance. Uh-huh. I mean, I feel like Bush was surfing a wave that was not necessarily something that he constructed, that was already sort of there. And he had his reasons as well in terms of the going into Iraq. But what kind of difference was there in terms of the support that existed for FDR? Because really, in many respects, that's before we had such a dominant war machine, war manufacturing machine, right? We don't have a base in or a weapons manufacturer in 75% of the congressional districts in the country. Who are all basically like, let's do this because you got a bunch of your, we got employment here, or we got whatever it is. We didn't have any of that. And we did in the run up, in the wake of 9/11, in the run up to the Iraq War. And I imagine that also impacts things. Just give me a sense of like, you know, how much that existed and how would you characterize the difference between what FDR was doing and what, say, Bush was doing? Because it just feels like the power was far more dispersed during Bush.
Yeah, and I'll talk later about the difference in tactics between the two presidents. I think you're more probing the societal basis of support for some, you know, these hawkish positions. And I would commend you a book by my friend Stephen Wertheim, Tomorrow the World. I don't know if you've had him on, but
many times.
You know, since my book came out, he's laid out in much more detail kind of there's a foreign policy elite that is forming during this period, you know, and he's looking at the Council on Foreign Relations task forces that are formed in 1940 to look at these questions. And the people around Roosevelt are very much from the foreign policy establishment. And their general view was, I would describe it as pro-British more than anything else, this sense that, you know, if Britain goes down, everything we stand for, you know, an economically open world or a world that's friendly to American power and influence is going to be threatened. And so I would say this nascent foreign policy elite is the key group. And, you know, people like FDR's Secretary of War, Henry Stimson, his Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, the top military leaders, they all represent different strains of this, but they're all part of the elite in that respect. But there are also plenty of elites that were skeptical of war in their own way. I mean, in terms of, you know, I'd say the same actually applies to Iraq in this respect. It's not that I'm not a believer in the military-industrial complex, but what they excel at is large defense budgets, mostly, I would say, first and foremost. And if these moments where war is on the table, it's usually a group of high-powered elites in government and out who are arguing that kind of the broader American position in the world will be threatened if we don't take decisive action against this threat. And part of what motivates my book is this group is usually much more tolerant of the idea of war than, I would say, society at large, who doesn't have the same investment in, you know, I'd say, you know, the broader American position in the world than this elite group and is more sensitive to the cause.
I also wonder, you know, I perceive the Iraq and sort of the post 9/11 era as like the opportunity to find a new boogeyman too. Right. I mean, this was, we were sort of floating around for a while with this notion of like, we would get a peace dividend. And that was, you know, while I grant you, like, you know, if I'm a defense contractor now, I'm worried about the defense budget, but I'm not convinced that in the late 90s, I'm not worried. I'm looking at this going like, if we don't find something, this peace dividend may actually materialize. you know, maybe if Al Gore gets elected in a second, it wasn't going to happen under Clinton, but Al Gore maybe, you know, was going to give us a peace dividend or something like that. And I'm not convinced that they weren't quite excited at that point for at least something, you know, to sort of prove that we need to spend this cash essentially on and sell this stuff.
Well, as always, I can't remember, it might have been Colin Powell, but often military folks are the most gruff and candid about these things. And there are a few choice quotes right after the Cold War ends where these folks will just say, well, you know, we're going to have to go out and find another threat, you know. So there certainly is that. With Iraq in particular, I think the right entree into this case, relative to the World War II one, I would argue that in general, the domestic environment was more permissive for reasons we can get into. I'd say largely because of 9/11 and the revenge psychology that kicked in. But weirdly enough, because of that, the Bush administration, I'd say, was much less subtle in its deceptions than the Roosevelt administration, to the extent that a lot of the stuff they were saying about the WMD threat and the linkages with al-Qaeda were very easy to discredit, even at the time, you know, which kind of begs the question, why did they think they could just say this stuff out loud in a kind of democratic marketplace of ideas and get away with it? And the point I try to make in the book is kind of the establishment Democrat types made it, I think, a decision just not to push back too hard. Partly because of 9/11, but partly because they expected war to be a cakewalk. And if you oppose a war that ends up being a cakewalk, you suffer a political cost.
I think we could say that definitively for Kerry and for Clinton. I mean, I've spoken to Senator Russ Feingold on this program not too long ago, who said he sat in the Senate caucus. He said those people said. By those people, I mean the people who are running for president. We should not do this. And then he watched them walk on the floor and vote for it. And certainly Kerry was terrified of being on the wrong side of this, like he was, or he perceived he was in the first invasion, the Kuwait-Iraq war, if you will, I guess. I can't remember what we called it at the time, Operation
Desert.
Was it Desert Storm? I have the playing cards, but I don't know the. It was Desert Storm. So that seems to be there too. But there was also a massive failure by the media, though too, wasn't there? I mean, because I remember there were Knight Ridder did a very good job on uncovering this stuff at the time, but this stuff was all sort of buried back there, and there was. I mean, I wonder if the world of social media wouldn't have made a difference at that time, because media was still such in a way that it could be manipulated from top down. And there was no way, you know, there were blogs, but there was no way to really sort of like flush things out a little bit. Like there was no churn.
Yeah. And you all are more of the experts, I think, on the way the media ecosystem works than I am. But I agree with you. If you read a key piece by Michael Massing in the New York Review of Books, it's a postmortem on the media's performance. And this, you find this also in the scholarship that we tend to read on the way media and politics works. The problem is it's called elite indexing, where the media often over relies on key elites for the story on issues like this initially. And unless you can get these elites to actually disagree with each other on the merits, you tend to get a bandwagoning effect where, well, everybody's, you know, this Democrat and this Republican all agree. So it's safe for us to kind of say this is more likely true than not. I think there's something else going on. You know, having lived through that time too, I do think, I don't know how else to put it. I think 9/11 made people lose their minds a little bit.
Absolutely.
In the sense that much more than later, I think there was this nagging feeling that to ask hard questions was just wrong after, quote, we had been attacked. And this kind of gets to the basic motives for the Iraq War. I think the simplest explanation that I can accept after reading enough of this is the Bush administration decided that the U.S. had been attacked because we were seen as weak. And it was time to kind of reassert American power to restore our reputation for kind of ruthlessness. And Afghanistan just wasn't sufficient for this. And the thing about Iraq was it was already an adversary that a lot of people accepted as a bad guy. And a lot of people did want Saddam out of power anyway. So it kind of made sense in that respect. But the problem was, even given the relative public openness to doing something, in our society, you can't go to war when there's no obvious threat. So they had to say something specific about WMD, about terrorism. And ironically, the ones who understood the problem with this were the arch hawks, Rumsfeld and Cheney.
Yeah.
It's why they wanted to skip the UN process, because they understood if you had to go down the road of debating the fine points on this, you might lose momentum and got called out. So they just wanted to attack with that. It was Colin Powell and Tony Blair. I don't want to say they were more dishonest, but they were willing to kind of, they wanted diplomacy bad enough, or the appearance of diplomacy bad enough, that they encouraged a debate that forced the administration to say misleading things. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, that does make sense. I know what you're saying. I mean, because, you know, supposedly Colin Powell was doing this over about integrity. And there's been a very explicit, in my mind, sort of reformation project that his number two at the time, and his name escapes me at the moment,
Wilkerson,
has been running for the past 10, 12 years, 15 years, when they basically say, like, that moment, the night before when Tenet gave, who was a CIA head, gave Powell the information to go to the UN, that was the worst day of our lives, when we knew that we were sort of exaggerating a little bit. And it's like, well, there was much worse days for other people that were about to come in the wake of that. But I'm curious as to why you think it was, like, what cohort was it that thought it was about projecting U.S. muscularity, if you will? Like, because, I mean, I remember when Wolfowitz said, in his testimony, weapons of mass destruction was the one thing we could all agree on. And so there was a wide array of different reasons. Thomas Friedman wanted to break, you know, the bubble of the asymmetry of, you know, whatever garbage that he had made up for himself to sort of justify attacking Iraq, which I think, you know, he probably has his had reasons that were a little bit less tortured that he held more closely to his vest. But and I think that Rumsfeld had a military theory. Cheney, I think, had a sense of this is the way to prevent China from dominating that region. He was very, very keyed in on China for years and years. You know, the whole project for a new American century was like, how do we keep low-level conflicts going around the world and not allow for a sort of a second superpower to emerge? And one of the ways you do that is control the spigot of the oil. You don't necessarily get it for yourself. You can make sure that they don't get it to fuel their economy at that time. But what was the cohort that was like looking for that muscularity, as it were?
Well, I don't know if I necessarily, I think Cheney and Rumsfeld are key here. Although I actually think Bush himself actually exerted much more authorship over this than he's usually given credit for, and he might be a bit idiosyncratic. But in terms of this, in terms of the strategic case for war, I think Rumsfeld and Cheney especially are crucial. And the thing I would point out about them is they had been hawks of long standing, in the sense that they had served in government since the time of Vietnam, And I think each of them had a certain sense that, you know, it's a very interesting way to react to Vietnam, right? Rather than looking at Vietnam and saying, boy, it was wrong and wasteful to, you know, expend so many lives in a conflict like that, you know, in the periphery, they reacted to it and said, isn't it terrible how Americans came to doubt, you know, their own power and righteousness after Vietnam, and the president was reined in. And, you know, there's this continuing interest in kind of credibility for credibility's sake from that time onward. And that is what I see as the kind of overarching emphasis. You're right, there are differences. Wolfowitz is the one most interested in democracy in the Middle East and the transformation of the region. I think Bush was also in that camp ultimately, in that I think he had the sense that another 9/11, we could never allow it to happen again on his watch or anybody else's, and the only real fix was to transform the region. But in terms of just planting the seed, right, the people, well, you mentioned the Project on a New American Century. The folks that tended to be obsessed with Iraq were those, I'd say, who were hawkish and connected Iraq to American primacy. What they didn't like about Iraq and Saddam was their open defiance of American power. And that's why they wanted him gone, ultimately. He was just this running example of the U.S. not being able to impose its will on defiant actors.
Yeah, and how much of that, too, is like, I just want to touch on this as well, the anxiety that the kind of end of history era after the fall of the Soviet Union and the United States, it becoming the lone superpower for, you know, probably a short period of time, we're on a decline, like this desire to act and preserve that. And that can only be done through these aggressive actions. Like, how much do you think that that motivated the Bush administration, even if it was subconsciously, in Iraq?
Yes, I think this is quite key. This is what we in the IR business call the unipolar era, where the United States is the only great power ostensibly in the system. And I think if you look, there's that famous quote, I think, that was eventually attributed to Karl Rove, where he says to someone, you know, we are history's actors and the rest of you just react. They had a very imperial sensibility that the United States is just in a different category from everybody else because we are at the top of the heap. And when you're at the top of the heap, it's almost your responsibility to order the world. And in fact, this is why they thought, even as our allies were telling us, we're not sure we like this idea, they really thought that once you invade, the allies would go, actually, we were wrong and thank you, because this is what, right? They don't understand the responsibilities of being the superpower. And yeah, they're griping, but, you know, they'll come around when they see we ultimately did the right thing. Now, since that time, this is kind of an increasingly foreign sensibility to most of us with, you know, the resurgence of Russia and the rise of China and the financial crisis and the pandemic. But you kind of have to transport yourself back to a time when America felt far more ascendant. And in that respect, the problem with 9/11 is a kind of, how dare you do that to us? Mm-hmm. You don't do that to the United States. You know, someone needs to be made an example of.
Yeah, I feel like that was certainly, you know, what you would get out of the sort of the right wing, the media enterprise anyways. I just keep thinking of that like Lee Greenwood song or something. We're going to put a boot in your ass, yeah, that type of thing.
Or suck on this.
That was and suck on this.
Yeah.
Thomas Friedman had the same sort of like attitude. You know, we needed to send our boys and girls to Baghdad, to Basra. And, you know, which part of this do you not understand? He was famous for saying that was after the invasion, frankly.
Right.
All right. So let's just move to where we are today. And I should also just say the Project for New American Century perceived that notion of us being the hyperpower and all these other. I mean, so there it was. Those low level conflicts, we're supposed to be fighting them over there. So we're not fighting them over here type of situation.
Right. Yeah.
All right. So let's talk about, you know, Biden's this is sort of like an inverse on some level. There seems to be that Biden is sort of like trying not to get involved in Ukraine, at least in terms of like an actual, U.S. military personnel directly engaging. We're obviously we're selling weapons, but he seems to be steadfastly avoiding giving Putin the opportunity to say that we're engaging in this. Give us your sense of that. And also, is Putin having to lie in the way that, let's say, George Bush lied, is Putin having to do this? And what's involved in his job in terms of doing that?
Well, let me start with the latter part of the question. And a point I make in the book, and I don't really bear it out empirically, but I do think it's well-founded, is autocrats are generally, again, less subtle about any of this than their democratic counterparts. You know, if you think about the way that the Nazis, I think, killed a few Polish border guards and then said, you know, the Poles that attacked them, nobody really believes this. I think Putin was up to something similar. And one of the interesting wrinkles here is all the intelligence disclosures. So our intelligence community was basically telegraphing a day ahead or 2 days ahead of every, you know, escalatory move that the Russians were taking. And I do think they were going to stir up something, I want to say in the East, you know, as a pretext to justify a, quote, a peacekeeping operation. But our intelligence folks simply got out ahead of it. So autocrats will do something. It is interesting how even autocrats feel the need to justify these wars in certain terms. I agree. I don't think Biden has any interest in a war with Russia over Ukraine. And I talk about in my book, Deception for Peace, in the conclusion. And my guess is you might see a bit more of this than deception for war. So in the Korean War, we actively suppressed the fact that the Soviets were fighting us in the air over Korea. This was a highly sensitive, we didn't want anybody to know about this, because if people knew about it, they might want to escalate to fight the Soviets back. I would suspect that there are things happening in Ukraine that, that we're choosing not to talk about because the Biden administration doesn't want to be pressured to be more hawkish than it wants to be.
Obama sort of did this. I mean, obviously the stakes are different and we're not talking about war, but Obama did this, when he got those early reports about Russian interference in the election and supposedly, Mitch McConnell said, if you do this, I'm going to make it highly political. I mean, Obama could have still done it. He could have still made an issue. A lot of people think he should have. But didn't want to sort of stir this up. And you're suggesting that it's more than likely that the Biden administration is doing something similar as a way of making sure that there is not a domestic explosion of sentiment for us to get more involved. Because right now the polling is, you know, people think that Biden's not doing enough.
Yes. And I guess I would say that both we and the Russians have an interest in not playing up too much any direct contact between us over Ukraine, because neither side, I think, at the moment wants a war. So, for example, I suspect we have folks in Ukraine, special operators. You know, I find it hard to believe all of our folks just left. In terms of how we're getting weapons into Ukraine, the Russians, let's say, you know, God forbid they capture one of our contractors who's advised, you know, are they going to make a big deal and parade this person? Maybe not, because they don't want to give us any reason to have to escalate. So you were right to ask the question the way you did. It's a very different structural situation, I think, from the ones we've talked about thus far. You would have known that there was some interest in escalation if this no-fly zone debate had gone any further, but the fact that it was shut down so quickly suggests to me that there's no interest there. And I think it's because, obviously, because of nuclear weapons. So.
Well, okay, well, I'm sorry. I just want to follow up on that. Like, why wouldn't it behoove Putin to say, hey, you know, we're fighting NATO in there, let's say. Is it specifically he doesn't want the U.S.? I mean, because I would think that and it feels like there were moments where he was looking to maybe antagonize NATO enough so that, because it's, you know, at one point it looked like it was a hard sell for him domestically that he is attacking Ukraine, although the numbers seem to suggest the polling, if you can believe them, in Russia, is that they don't know. And you keep reading stories of Ukrainians who have like relatives in Russia, and they can't even convince their relatives that what Putin is saying is wrong. But was there a time where Putin was like, maybe I need to like NATO-fy this as a way of stirring more domestic support?
Well, I guess I always have the bias that leaders are at least a little bit rational. And there are plenty of folks who think Putin is not. But as tough as the fight in Ukraine is, a war against NATO is simply unwinnable in all sorts of ways. And so, again, I don't have a direct read into his mind, but to me, it's just strikingly irrational to kind of do something like that. Leaders do occasionally do irrational things. Now, I will say one thing I've been worried about, a number of us have been worried about, is, you know, if he's losing in Ukraine and a major reason is a flow of arms coming in from NATO, I guess how patient is he going to be about allowing that to continue? You know, this was the concern with the fighter jets flying in, like from Germany into Ukraine. And, you know, for example, in Afghanistan, the reason I used to work at a war college teaching military officers, and they'd come back from Afghanistan, and to have to put up with the Pakistanis supplying, you know, your enemy day in and day out, and you can't do anything about it. It's enraging, right? So that is what I was, you know, do tend to worry about, is even if he's rational, you know, there are certain interests everybody has in not making this a wider war, but that's a point of tension, the supply effort.
Did you have?
No, go on. I actually forgot what I was going to say.
Okay. John Schluss.
No, go ahead. That's fine.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, it's just to bring it back to the one of the central theses of your book in terms of the way Biden's de-escalating, right? The inverse is, of course, true, is when information comes out from administrations that want to escalate the conflict, that's purposeful as well. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you all know this and savvy people know this, but, you know, when you're presented with intelligence by the government on a sensitive issue, it's eminently political, right? You don't know how representative that intelligence is or why it's being presented in the context it is at that moment. But what you do know is it's because they want to convince you of something. And I think we all need to be more sophisticated in the way we consume this stuff. That's what still troubles me about Iraq, is just how uncritical people. Well, Colin Powell went before the UN and, yep, you know, he told us these things in this order. And, you know, well, really? That you don't have any follow on questions, you know, about how powerful this information is. So we always need to keep that in mind.
That was an ugly time. It's almost like also like when you read Politico, it's the same thing. You're always wondering, like, somebody wants me to know this. Mm-hmm. Who is it and why do they want me to know it are the questions you should be asking. John Schluss, associate professor of government and public service at Texas A&M, author of Deceit on the Road to War, Presidents, Politics, and American Democracy. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, this was great. Thank you so much.
All right, folks, going to head into the fun half of the program. 646-257-3920 is the phone number, which you can call to be part of this program. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get the free show, free of commercials, and you get the fun half. And, oh, did we put out the live show for members? Have we done that yet? Let's do it. Okay, so we'll do that. You'll have that today. Members will get in the live show.
Big live.
It won't actually be live. But speaking of the big live, the original big live.
There's another bite at the apple for the big live.
Exactly. That's in Boston. Boston, Mass. The Wilbur Theater. Chris Rock is like sold out the Wilbur Theater.
That was his first show back. Yeah.
Now, our tickets are about 12 times less expensive than this. I saw these like tickets were going for like $480 or something. Yeah. And the last ones that were available.
Hey, look, I mean, this is a silver lining for getting bitch slapped on TV.
If you want to go to the Wilbur and sit in the same place that people were sitting when Chris Rock was in there, but instead you want to do it for like $35, head over to Majority Live, click on the link, get in there. I think we still have some seats left, and you will not want to miss this. Believe me. You're going to be sorry. Let me put it this way. Obviously, if you're like, I live in California, I'm not going to that show. But if you're on the fence, you're like, I might go, I might not go, do yourself a favor.
If you're in Maine.
Go. If you're in Maine, south, if you're anywhere within an hour north of Portland, it's a no-brainer. Let's put it that way.
You're anywhere within an hour north of Portland.
Hour north of Portland. Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So the rate, like, you know.
But why aren't we doing the radius of Boston?
You could do it that way.
Okay.
He said Maine.
Ah.
Yeah. So if you live in Maine,
No
reason not to.
If you live anywhere else in New England, it's a slam dunk.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe if you're like in Stamford, Connecticut, but we don't have people listen to us in Stamford, Connecticut anyway. So
no, not anymore.
Frick that. No way. The quickie didn't go out today. Otters are cool. I don't know where your quickie is, but it went out. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code Majority and you get 10% off. Also, you get the Majority Report blend. Check it out now. JustCoffee.coop. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian Media Universe?
Left Reckoning just accomplished 20,000 subscribers on YouTube. So go help us get to 25,000. Yes. And patrons can listen to we had a conversation with my buddy Chris Leal, who ran for office in Dallas, about how as his first time running for office, what he learned trying to make the word progressive okay to say in Texas, and how he got union support, and how he ultimately only lost by 200 votes, and what to do next time. So patreon.com/leftreckoning to get access to that conversation.
All right, folks, see you in the fun half. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority
Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt!
Fun. What is up, everyone? Fun.
Nomi Keen.
You did it! Fun. Let's go, Brandon!
Fun.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today!
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this...
7-8. Yes.
Hi, me? Is it?
Yes.
Is it me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is it me? Hello, is it me?
I think it is you. Who is you?
us out every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go start
off. Libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge me.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less.
But let me say this.
Poop.
You can call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we seen you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.